Welcome to the Hoopsite Podcast. My name is Alex Kennedy. Joining me today is a special guest who's a 14-year NBA veteran. He was an all-star with the Orlando Magic, and he also had stints with the Dallas Mavericks, Boston Celtics, Denver Nuggets, New Orleans Pelicans, Chicago Bulls, and Detroit Pistons. My guest is Jameer Nelson. Jameer, how are you, man?
I'm good, Alex. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great. So before we get started and talk about your career and everything, I want to give you a shout-out from 14-year-old Alex. I haven't told the story in the podcast, but I have to say it here. I started covering NBA games when I was 14 years old. The Orlando Magic PR department was amazing. Jason Wallace, Joel Glass. They let me cover games when I was a kid and was trying to figure out if being a sports writer is something I wanted to do. And I always tell people, you were the first person I ever interviewed. Not even first athlete, first person ever. I walked up in the locker room and you were a rookie. I interviewed you and you were so friendly and so helpful. I always tell people you and Steve Francis were the nicest people to me when I was a 14-year-old. It was clueless and had no idea what I was doing in a locker room as a media member. And you joked with me and you said, you know, if the outlet you're working for isn't paying you, then I need to be your agent. I'll make sure you're getting paid. And you were just so friendly. And I want to thank you for that because, you know, I was obviously a kid and you didn't benefit at all from taking time out of your day to talk to me and help me out. But I always appreciated that. So I want to tell that little story.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's funny because you say I don't benefit from it. I probably did benefit from it more than you thought or think because, you know, when you're a professional athlete, being kind and nice to people is the biggest part of the job. I mean, we're on a platform that, one, people will listen and people recognize us, people are aware of who we are. And, you know, I was taught a long time ago, it takes nothing. It costs nothing to be nice to somebody. It costs nothing to give people compliments. And that's the way I am. I mean, you know, I like to treat people the way I like to be treated myself. So, you know, not knowing, you know, down the line, I will be talking to you on this podcast or anything like that. But you never know, man. You never know when you'll meet somebody in a different place and what status that person will be in or status you'll be in as well. I mean, you know, like I probably told you back in the day, you had to be brave to be 14 to walk in the NBA locker room to interview professional athletes, and I'm sure you were a little nervous. So me seeing that kind of helped you break the ice. I kind of, you know, made some jokes with you and tried to break the ice for you and help you out.
Yeah, it helped me a ton because, I mean, like you said, I was nervous. I had no idea what I was doing. That whole first year, I feel like I was just kind of monitoring what other writers were doing and trying to blend in and learn from watching them. So to be able to have people like you and Steve that kind of pulled me aside and helped me out, it was really great. I don't know if I would be here today without help from you guys and the Orlando Magic PR department and just all the people that kind of opened doors for me and helped me back then. So I do really appreciate that. And I feel like you know, you were always great with everyone. You were a terrific leader. You were always someone that got, you know, your teammates together in the off season for different team bonding exercises. You guys would, you know, go paintballing and watch movies and go bowling. And, you know, I feel like everyone, whether it was a team employee, a teammate, someone in the media, a ball boy, everyone seemed to gravitate toward you. Were you always, you know, someone that was a great leader, or is that something that you had to learn over time?
No, I just think that was natural. I just think it's my personality. And it's just who I am. I mean, who I was raised to be. I think I lead in my own way. And you know, normally that works. I mean, when you're trying to be a leader, you try to act like a leader, you know, people normally can read through the BS. But like I said, I tell my son this, he's a freshman in college, you know, lead in your own way. You know, if you're not a yeller or a screamer, people will read right through that. And the message you're trying to deliver in an unnatural way won't get delivered the way you should or it should be delivered.
So you can definitely tell that, yeah, you were raised the right way. When you got to the NBA, or even when you were in college, who were some of the vets that helped you the most? Because I feel like you were that veteran for a lot of players that were kind of coming up. Who was the vet that you kind of credit for helping you and kind of showing you the ropes early on?
Well, I had, you know, great vets. I had Steve Francis, who helped me out a lot. I had Grant Hill, Stacey Augman, Pat Garrity, Tino Mobley. I mean, the list goes on. Is, you know, a lot of these guys, you know, these younger guys won't even know who they are, or if they do, they probably don't know much about them. But, you know, and I was fortunate to have a great supporting cast in the organization, to lead as well. Otis Smith and, you know, like you said, Joe Glass and, you know, all those guys who helped you helped me as well. I was fortunate. I was obviously upset getting, you know, slipping in the draft, but it was a blessing in disguise, because I went to an organization who wanted me for me and loved who I was as a person and a player.
You had so much longevity and success throughout your career. What would you say is your advice for players that are coming to the league now, especially players, like you said, that may not have went as high as they wanted to in the draft, or guys that come in with a chip on their shoulder? What advice would you have for a guy that wants to have, you know, a 10-plus year career like you did?
To not allow anybody to outwork them. I mean, the sacrifices you make in the beginning will be great for you in the end. I mean, the one thing, I never took a summer off. I never took a summer off for working out. I always stayed and had a great routine. And you know, any team I played for, they never had to watch over top of me because I was committed, and they knew that. They knew I was going to come back in the best shape I could and you know, and try to get better at something I wasn't as good at in the previous year.
Your most recent NBA stint was with the Detroit Pistons in 2018. You weren't with the team last season, but you never retired. And earlier this year, you told The Athletic in an interview that you stayed in shape and, you know, you're ready if you get that call. Do you still hope to play in the NBA again? And are you still in shape now?
I'm still in shape. And I think that got a little fabricated, you know, in the interview a little bit. Kind of what I told those guys is I said, you know, things, you know, crazy things happen. You know, a team may call and say, hey, we want you. You know, at this point in time, I'm enjoying my time off with my family and trying to start a new career in broadcasting. So I'm focusing on that right now. But I'm a guy that's always gonna be in shape. Like I said, I've never been a guy who takes a summer off. So why would I do it now? But I'm not looking, you know, to get back in the NBA. I'm looking more at the broadcasting career and. I told those guys that crazy things happen. Crazy. I mean, you see Melo, he sat out for a year and a half, and now he's the player of the month.
Right.
So the NBA is unique. It's a unique business where, you know, somebody may call. And like I said, I haven't officially retired. But, you know, realistically, the chances of somebody calling is, you know, unrealistic. So, but I'm not, like I said, I'm not officially retired.
Well, how's the broadcasting pivot going, and what are some things that you've kind of done to prepare for that post-basketball career?
Well, I just recently, last Friday, I did CBS Sportsnet College Basketball in a booth with Chris Over and John Rothstein, and, you know, it was great. I mean, I did a program in L.A. At USC that the NBA Player Association puts on for a limited amount of guys, just learning things and, you know, certain nuances that will help you in a broadcasting career.
I know some guys, they transition to broadcasting or coaching. I think you're going to be great in broadcasting, by the way. But I know some guys have that itch, especially when, you know, they haven't retired yet, when they still have that door open. You sound like you're, you know, comfortable outside of the NBA and you're fine if you don't play again. But what was that like for you kind of adjusting to not being in the NBA, especially when the season rolls around and, you know, you're so used to that habit of, okay, now it's time for training camp and now this or that. What was it like kind of going through that for the first time and not being in the league?
It's tough. I mean, for 14 years, I prepared for one thing and, you know, had a timetable to get ready for that. And I still did that last year and it didn't come. So that was probably the toughest part. Now this year, you know, I was a little more realistic, like if it didn't happen last year, it's not going to happen this year. So I didn't prepare as much as I did before, but I continue, like I said, to stay in shape and do things. But it's tough. I mean, you know it's coming to an end. There's no real preparation for it. You can't say I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, and I'm going to be okay, because ultimately I'm a basketball player. That, I mean, that's who I am outside of my personal life. So it's one of the things that I'm still getting used to. I don't think I'll ever get used to not playing the game at the highest level. But I have a lot to offer, whether it's broadcasting, coaching, mentoring, teaching on the court, whatever the case may be. I think I have a lot to offer to the game. And, you know, it's because of guys like Grant and Stacey, those guys who were great veterans to me. You know, you have to give back to the game. And you know, during my 14 years, I think I've been able to reach guys, younger guys, and get to them and stress certain things to them that will allow them to be good professionals, like my veterans passed on to me.
Yeah, you've always been great at that with the young players on, teams you've been on. What drew you to broadcasting? Because I think coaching would make a lot of sense too. And you just mentioned it there. Is that something that you still have? Is that door you're going to leave open for the future maybe? Or are you definitely set on broadcasting? And if so, what kind of drew you toward broadcasting and not one of these other directions?
Well, right now, I'm definitely gonna leave the coaching door open. I see broadcasting as something it's fun to talk about the game. I love talking about the game. I love analyzing it. I love breaking it down, and I can criticize people and not get in trouble for it for the most part. So, coaching is a little more obviously hands on and time consuming and taxing. I just want, once I jump in coaching, I just need to know that that's just what I want to do for a long time. My family's okay with it. That's the most important thing. I think, being around my kids right now, my son's just started his freshman year at George Washington. My older daughter just started high school. So it's some things in life that you have to kind of, sacrifice and, if I did want to coach right now, it's timing for everything. I think time will tell you when it's ready, when you're ready for it.
For sure. As you kind of transition to broadcasting and learn more about that world and prepare for that career, what are some things that you've kind of, that have surprised you or that maybe you didn't understand when you were playing about that world that now you kind of understand that you're part of it?
Well, just how much, analyst or broadcaster knows. I mean, these guys like John Rothstein is, he's like my hero when I'm on set. Like I can ask him any question and he comes right back to me without a hesitation. And he, because he knows everything. He's a college basketball guru for a reason. I give him credit for what he does. And the first time I worked with him was last year in December. And it kind of opened up my eyes that, because when you're playing, you're like, oh, these people don't know anything, but a guy like John, he's so smart and so, so into his work that he's just like a head coach on the team.
That's awesome. Yeah. Before we move on and talk about your career some more, I do want to ask, I had Jose Calderon on the podcast and he was talking about how, he couldn't really work out for a season and not know he was going to get signed and stay in shape for that long and focus on it that long. What was it like for you to kind of go through that and work out every day and then not get that call? I know you're doing well now and you're moving on to broadcasting and you said it wasn't normal. It was kind of adjustment getting used to not being in the league and going and watching the games and all that, not being part of it. But I know that's a taxing thing when you're working out every single day and you think an NBA call may be coming. And then when it doesn't call, you've kind of stayed in shape and done that for nothing. Obviously, you want to stay in good shape anyway, but what was it like to kind of put yourself through that and then have that letdown?
Well, I've always said that I love the grind of getting ready for a season. So it wasn't frustrating that I was working out. It wasn't taxing because I love working out. I mean, that's the part that you have to love if you want to have a long career. I mean, the basketball going to play is the easy part. Once you love the gym, that's when you can actually work on things and get better. So for me, it was just, the hardest part was knowing how hard I was working and nobody giving me a chance. But like I said, things happen and they happen for a reason. So I continued to stay ready and just waited for the call.
You mentioned that, you're calling college games now and you're getting involved there. You obviously had a fantastic college career. It was amazing watching you play back then and obviously throughout your NBA career as well. But when you look at the current state of kind of college basketball, there's been a lot of talk about college athletes getting paid. You were one of those guys that when you were in college probably would have been very marketable or you were very marketable. You just didn't see any money from that. Do you feel like college athletes today should get paid?
I do. I do think they should get paid. And I think, the universities, NCAA, and the coaches are benefiting off these kids who are, basically the product. I'm not saying they should get millions of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars, but they should get a piece of the pie and it should be dispersed in different ways. I mean, obviously, if you're going to a Louisville, you're number one in the country right now, and your whole 20,000 in your arena, you may get a little more on that team. You know, if you go to a UAB, you might get less because you're not attracting as much. You're not marketing as much. So it's a line you have to walk and be like cautious about it because, you know, I think one of the reasons why they haven't figured it out is because how are you going to do it? Like, is it fair that, you know, a Louisville will get more money? Is it fair that a lesser team will get less money? And, you know, the world isn't fair. I mean, nobody's treated equal in this world and everybody's treated fair. But so my thing with that is, yeah, college players should get paid.
When you look at the college landscape now, how different is it from whenever you were coming up? Because, I mean, I look at it now and some of these kids have been in mixtapes from the time they were really young. Social media is obviously something that they're dealing with, and a lot of them have huge followings on social media, especially the big name guys. You know, obviously social media, I don't think, you know, Twitter specifically didn't pop up until you were in the league for a few years or, you know, at least early in your career. What do you think it would be like if you were in college and there were social media and mixtapes and all this stuff going on? And how different is the landscape today now that you're kind of diving back into it as an analyst?
Well, it's a distraction. It's a big distraction. You see guys in the gym and the first thing they do is they go grab their phone and get on social media in between a workout or in between a set. I get it. It's part of the world. But, you know, we overstimulate ourselves as human beings, myself included. So it is one of those things that you have to use it for the right reason. And if I'm working a kid out, they know phones off, don't touch your phone until the workout's over. No cameras allowed because nobody needs to see you work. It's not that important. Like, the reality of it is you think people care, but they really don't. They rather see you fall on your face. That's what I think a lot of kids don't understand. You know, you build this big social media following up, you know, which is great. And you should do that because nowadays a lot of guys are more worried about their brand than they are about winning. You know, you'll see some of these kids that it's about the brand. And, you know, I don't even know what social media platform was out when I was in college, but I didn't have it because it wasn't as big and it wasn't as important. But these kids are in a tough situation, tough spot because of social media. I mean, if you use it for the right reason, then and you use it to market the right way, then you can make a lot of money off of it. But if you're using it just because it gives you instant gratification because you'll put something up and people will like it or people will retweet it or people will, you know, comment. And I get it. We all need to feel good as human beings. We all need to and want to be liked by people, but what it does is it gives some people a voice who doesn't even need a voice, who don't even need a voice.
Yeah, that's a great point. I feel like you were someone that was always pretty mature for your age. You know, obviously, I didn't know you when you were, you know, way younger, but it seems like you always came across as much more mature than your peers. And, you know, where do you think that comes from? Just looking back, you know, to your childhood, how you were raised and all that. Was that something that was always the case? Were you always more mature than your peers?
I don't know, man. I've always hung out with older guys. So maybe that's it. Maybe my personality just attract older people. I had a kid at a younger age, so I had to mature a little faster. You know, I was, what, 19 when I had my son. So that, to me, like, you know, you got a kid at in college, and you have to survive. You have to figure it out. You have to figure out how he's going to eat. And, you know, I had a great supporting cast with my wife now and her parents, my parents, I mean, and some other people. But it's just all about your upbringing as well. I mean, my parents, I feel like, did a great job of disciplining me, but also allowing me to be out there in the world and figure some things out for myself. That could have gone either way, from where I grew up at. You know, you can easily get caught up in, you know, bad things. But I had people around me that, like I said, older people around me that, one, kept me out of trouble, and two, you know, told me the truth. I mean, I think a lot of these kids don't have people around them telling the truth. I think a lot of these people that are handling these kids' business for them and handling their lifestyle, they don't tell them the truth. And what actually happens is you enable the person, you enable the kid, and the kid doesn't get the life lesson that he needs. And whether the kid like it or not, like if a kid comes work out with me, I'm gonna tell him the truth. Like, I don't need you to like me as a person if that's not what you want to do. If you want to be around me, you're gonna like me because of who I am and what I'm about.
For sure. Yeah. You know, I feel like a lot of the people kind of view the kid as their meal ticket, you know, whether it's coaches or, you know, people in their life, friends, teachers, things like that. You mentioned a few times now, you know, working out kids. Are you working out high schoolers, college prospects? You know, what have you been doing when you've been working these guys out? Where do you do that? And kind of what level are you working guys out at?
So this past summer I had my son. So it was Jameer Jr. I had Josh Sharkey, which is my cousin. I had Isaiah Wong, who goes to the University of Miami. Hakeem Hart, who came a couple times and worked in, he goes to Maryland. So it's normally college kids. And that, to me, high school and college is where you need to get the kids. Once a guy gets to the NBA or becomes a professional player overseas, it's a little harder, not to teach them to play, but to break them down mentally. I like to break kids down a little bit mentally, put them in situations that one is uncomfortable for them. I think I'm a big person on, I'm big on being uncomfortable because that's how you get better. If you're always comfortable and you're always doing the same thing, how do you get better? So that to me is where you get the kids, high school and in college. So, I had a good group of kids. I didn't like start a business or anything like that. It was just some kids that in the area who I just wanted to get work with. I mean, my son, obviously, that was actually like one of the first times we actually could work together and be like coach player instead of father son. It's harder when you're father son. You kind of butt heads. But last summer was really, it was kind of a breath of fresh air once he came to me and said he wanted to work.
Yeah, it's very cool. For any executives or scouts that may be listening, can you give the scouting report on your son?
No, man, no scouting report. I don't want to give a scouting report because he got a lot of college games left.
Okay, I got you.
Can and cannot do. I know what he can and cannot do. I know what his tendencies are for sure.
We don't want any opposing head coaches listening.
No opposing college head coaches listening. I mean, they watch their film and all that stuff. And I watch the games and I send him my notes. So the next time he plays, he can get better at the things that he needs to get better at.
Well, he has a good person in his corner. I love it. Speaking of people and their games, are there any current NBA point guards whose game, you know, reminds you of yours or is somewhat similar to yours? You know, younger guys or any up and coming guys, even in college. Are there any point guards that you kind of look at and think, you know, that guy kind of plays like me?
I mean, it's some guys have similarities. I mean, you look at a Van Fleet who not a ton of athleticism, not a guy who's gonna blow by you, smaller guard. But when you look up, he gets the job done. I mean, he wins his matchups a lot of the nights. And that was always my goal. If I win my matchup, then I gain respect from the guy that I played against and my teammates. So he, you know, a guy like Van Fleet from where he came from and where he's at now, kind of, it's remarkable to see him grow as a player. It is. I mean, you know, people basically didn't give him a chance, you know, other than the Toronto Raptors. And he's proven a lot of people wrong. And that just shows you that, you know, it's all about situations. It's all about people believing in you and having that confidence in you and allowing you to be who you are. And I think the Toronto Raptors are allowing Van Fleet to play his game and be himself.
Yeah, that's a really good one. He's a super humble, down-to-earth, friendly dude, too. So I like that comparison on and off the court. That's a good one. Who are your favorite up-and-coming players in the NBA now that, you know, you've had a chance to watch?
I mean, it's hard not to, for me, it's hard not to love watching LeBron James. The one thing people do is they, you know, we get bored with success, and he's been successful for 16 years, and this is his 17th year. Even last year, to me, if 90% of the NBA had a season like LeBron, then that's a really successful season.
Yeah.
But because he set the bar and the standards so high for himself, when he has a, you know, I don't, if he averaging 30 points and next year he averaged 27, people are going to say he's having an off year. But the reason why I love watching LeBron is because every year he comes back with hunger and fire, and he comes back trying to be better. And you have to give the guy credit. Not a guy in the league has sustained that level that he's playing at for 17 years. And to me, he's been the best player for most of those years.
Yeah, we definitely take him for granted. I feel like the media, fans, they don't appreciate, you know, that we're watching an all-time great player, and they do want to, you know, knock his stats at sometimes if it's not, you know, what it was in his prime. But, I mean, he's damn near close to it. It's pretty impressive to see what he's doing. I mean, can you speak to how tough it is to have that kind of longevity and still be almost averaging, you know, 30 points and a triple-double at this stage?
I can't because I've never done it, but I mean, the thing to me as a fan at this point, as a peer, it's like I said, it's one of the greatest things I've ever seen. And, you know, like you said, we take it for granted that it's LeBron and he's just going out there and doing that. Like, no, like, you know, I would tell people, you put that uniform on, you put those shoes on, and you try to do it for a 10 game stint. Try to do what he's doing for 10 games. He's doing it for 82. Or just say if he plays 75 games, he's going for 75 games and in the playoffs and in the finals. So it's not like it's a fluke. He's a guy that has, he's changed the game. I mean, I don't know if we'll ever see an athlete like him. I mean, I've always told people he's probably one of the fastest human beings on the court. Like when I was young, he would take off running to try to block somebody's shot and you would just hear his shoes squeaking and you knew he was coming.
Yeah.
That's how fast he was. So it's like for a guy to be that size, have the longevity that he's had, it tells you a lot about his offseason. It tells you a lot about his passion for the gym. Like we talked about earlier about loving the gym. Like that, like he loves the gym. Like he's not posting, like he'll post videos of him working out, but it's like funny stuff.
Dancing, yeah,
or you know, stuff like that shows his personality. He's not trying to show videos of him working out to impress people, in my opinion.
No, you
know,
you're
he'll
right.
Give you a little footage. He'll give you a little footage and let you know, yeah, I'm working, but I'm also doing this movie type of stuff. But the more important thing is we don't see the hours that he's putting in. Like I'm sure he's putting in hour after hour, nap. Hour, like more hours, and we don't know that. Like, you know, I tell kids all the time, my workout regimen was, I mean, I would work out for 6-7 hours a day, but it would be naps in between, it'd be meals in between, it was scheduled, and then I would go have whatever fun I wanted to have, but I'm right back at it the next day.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think people have talked about he spends, you know, $1.5 million per year on his body, and teammates have said he prioritizes his recovery and his body over everything. So, yeah, I mean, he has to be playing this well at this stage. It's been so impressive to watch him do that. And, yeah, he definitely takes his offseason seriously. It's been incredible to watch his career. You guys, obviously, in Orlando, had some crazy postseason battles against him. He was someone that you guys ran into a few times. You defeated him. When I look back at those Orlando Magic teams and I look at the modern NBA, and actually I had a Brian Scalabrine on the podcast recently, and he pointed you guys out and said that was a team. He said the first time he played you guys was when he realized how much the NBA was changing and that basically there was no way to stop you offensively. You had to pick your poison, Dwight down low or the four shooters. And now you look at the NBA and it's all about versatility and 3-point shooting. When you look back at those teams, do you feel like you were on the cutting edge of kind of the modern NBA and that you guys were maybe ahead of your time even?
Yeah, I think so. I think we changed the game a little bit. I think you look at, you know, the way Golden State played in previous years and other teams, they tried to, and they did a good job of it, of mirror what we did. You know, have you had a big, tall guy like Hedo. You had a point guard who could shoot and make plays. You had somebody down low that can block shots and rebound and score. So you play four around one. And you play free. Like, you know, one thing about Stan is once we figured out the system as a team, he just let us go. Like, he just wanted to play as hard as we had to play or could play on defense. And offensively, he would just let us go. Like, he would just let us play. And that was a thing that is happening now. It's so much random basketball going on now, and on the good teams and good organizations. And even in college, you see a lot of random basketball, a lot of random cuts and pick and rolls. That's how we played. That's how we got teams off guard. You know, we never wanted to let a team set their defense and key in on one person. I mean, we obviously had a Hall of Famer in Dwight, and what made things a lot easier. But, you know, we still had to run that system, and I think we did change the game a little bit.
How much fun was that? I mean, having that kind of success, winning in individual and team success, you know, you become an all-star, the team is winning. You guys had a really nice stretch there. How much fun was that?
That was a lot of fun. I mean, it is what it is. I mean, if you win, you're going to have fun. When you're winning, you're having fun. It's a direct correlation. I mean, nobody likes to lose and have fun. So we won a lot of games for a lot of years in a row. I think it was like 4 or 5 years in a row we won 50-plus games. I think it was 4 years in a row. And that is not an easy thing to do because, you know, after the first year, the tape was out on us. You know, everybody knew exactly what we were going to do. And we had pieces in terms of, like, players coming in, coming out, like, you know, trades and signs and all that stuff. And we had to implement all these different things, but also be who we were. And we developed that culture early, and you give a guy like Stan credit for setting the tone. I mean, in the beginning, I didn't understand Stan because of his yelling and screaming. But once I understood, all this dude wants to do is win. That made you want to run through the wall for him.
For sure, yeah. Those teams were so much fun to cover, too. Just, I mean, you could tell you guys were having fun and really getting along and gelling and all that. It was cool to be around those teams, you know, early in my career. You mentioned Dwight Howard. You guys entered the NBA in 2004. As I mentioned, I met you your rookie year. That was the year you guys both entered the league. You guys, you know, spent a lot of time together over the years. You know, I feel like, do you feel like he's someone that's misunderstood? Because obviously, you know, there have been talks about, you know, chemistry issues and different teams and all this different stuff. He's having a great year now, and I'm happy for him having that resurgence. But do you feel like he's a misunderstood guy?
A little bit. I think he definitely was misunderstood on certain teams, and definitely, you know, I think he had to mature a little more, and it took a little longer than people thought. But he is who he is, and you know, if I'm a coach, I'm a player, like, you know, when we were on the same team, we accepted that as a teammate. Like, we knew who he was. If you care about a person and you care about a team, you'll take the time to understand them and take this time to kind of, you know, lead them in the right direction. And that was the one thing that we did in Orlando. We all led in our different way. But we had a lot of guys around Dwight that, great character guy, really important to the organization, and we led him, and he helped lead us as well. So we allowed him to be himself. And once he left Orlando, I think things got a little misconstrued of people saying he shouldn't laugh, he shouldn't joke. Well, that's him. That's who he was, and that's who he's always going to be. And at this point in his career, he's still doing the same thing. He's still silly, I'm sure. He still laughs and jokes, still has fun, make fun of people. But he's around, in my opinion, three of the greatest leaders that ever played the game. You got Rondo, you got LeBron, and you got Jason Kidd.
Yeah.
And those guys at this point in their career as well, they've seen enough of Dwight. They know his personality, so they know how to treat him. And he understands that, you know, this could be it for him. This could be it, and this could be his championship too. So he can't take it for granted, and nor can they as leaders. And they're doing a good job of putting him in the situation that's going to help him and the team be successful. Like I said earlier, it's all about situations when it comes to most players. Unless you're going to have the ball in your hands 75% of the time, you're a situational player. If you're a situational player, you have to be put in that situation.
For sure, yeah. I know Dwight's told people close to him, you know, he regrets leaving Orlando, or at least he wonders what would have happened if he'd stayed there. Because I think not only did he, you know, maybe take for granted the cast around him and how much, you guys helped him. I think he also, the media and the big markets and all that was a little more brutal than I think he expected. There were different things there that were happening. Do you ever wonder what would have happened had the core stayed together, if you guys had, a few more years together rather than, I know you were in Orlando still 2 years after Dwight left, but, that team started rebuilding. Do you ever wonder if that core stayed together, what would have happened?
Absolutely. I mean, the one thing is, like I said, we had a culture, and when that culture got broke, that's when the team started to break up. It was different reasons why the culture broke up. And the main thing was, certain guys weren't seeing eye to eye anymore. And the goal changed, like social media started to come into play. The brand started to get bigger for individual guys. And winning wasn't much, or it wasn't even the priority at that time, in my opinion, for certain guys. So it kind of got blown up because of that, in my opinion. I mean, I'm sure you've been around and you've seen it, but it kind of deflates you when, you kind of like, I don't feel like coming to practice today because it's not going to be as fun. Like, practice used to be fun. When we were winning, like I said, everything was fun. But when things got a little tougher and adversity hit, certain guys just didn't want to be there anymore.
I felt bad for you guys during that season whenever the trade request happened, because it felt like you guys were constantly being asked questions and having to answer for something that you didn't sign up for. What was it like going through that year where there's a national spotlight on the team and it's not for the right reason? It's not for going to the finals or winning games. What was it like going through that trade request year?
Well, that's the first time we had to deal with something like that in Orlando. In my stint there, it was different because every day we came, it was like about Dwight wanting to be traded, Dwight wanting Stan to get fired. Anything they everybody found anything but positive things to say against us or to us. I thought we handled it well. We still continued to win. We still played. We fought through it. But it was just a lot of weight on, I think everybody's shoulder. I mean, even the coaching staff, it was, it took a lot out of you to deal with all that negativity. And all that stuff, like I said, a lot of things that happen in professional sports just need to stay in the locker room or in the office that it needs to be in, whether it's with the general manager, the owner, the president. If you want to have a conversation with that person, just let it stay there. And, if you want to request a trade, request it quietly. And things won't then trickle down to your coach, your teammates, fans. It took effect on everybody. I mean, people working on the business side, nobody was having fun anymore. It was almost like the ending to a great movie. And it was a sad ending.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great way of putting it. Have you guys talked, you and Dwight, have you talked since that all went down? Because I asked because I did an interview with Penny Hardaway recently, and he talked about, when Shaquille O'Neal left for Los Angeles, Penny was kind of upset and said, look, you just cost me rings. You affected my legacy. He was really frustrated, and he eventually, after a lot of time, talked to Shaq, and they were, talked it out and everything like that. But he did admit, that he felt some sort of way toward Shaq for a long time. Have you and Dwight ever, talked things out since that all went down?
Yeah, we haven't had a sit down, like an adult conversation, like, you break bread with your friend over a meal and you talk about some things that are, in a professional way, but a little touchy, a little sensitive on both ends. So, I just knew or felt that, we had a good thing going. And like I said, the culture was built. All we had to do was continue to be there and be who we were as individuals in the community and players on the court. To put all of it on Dwight is not fair. To say if he would have stayed, things would have been the same, or he's the reason why everything broke up. It's not fair. I mean, because there's other things that transpired as well, I'm sure. And there's certain things that we probably would never know. But yeah, I definitely would like to sit down and talk with him one day, and I've always been a guy who's been rooting for him, always been on his side to, you know, come out on top. But, you know, I'm definitely looking forward to that day to sit down and talk with him and iron some things out.
For sure, yeah. You mentioned other things happening too. You know, Rashard Lewis gets traded at one point. You had, I know Tony Battee and Courtney Lee were, you know, guys that were beloved in the locker room, among others, obviously other players too. But there were other changes happening to the team as well. When you're in a situation like that and you have a team and something good is happening, is it kind of frustrating when it's out of your control, when different moves are happening and, you know, guys you may be really close to are being sent out in trades and all that? What was that kind of like being at the height of a contending team and then having, I mean, obviously they were trying to improve the team. It was all done to try to put the team over the edge. But what was that kind of like going through that?
I mean, it was tough. I mean, like I said, the culture was built. I'm gonna continue to say that.
Yeah.
And you just got to keep implementing things and do things the right way when other pieces come in. And it's tough because you spend so much time with these guys, you know, some of them basically become your family. I mean, you have over Thanksgiving, Christmas dinners, and you know, your families, your kids get close, your wives get close, and it's, that's just tough. It's one of the things when, and it's not having to do with Gilbert, because Gilbert was like, I was really cool with Gilbert.
Yeah, yeah.
But when Rashard got traded, that was like that hurt me because Rashard and I were so tight, and our families were so tight. So that was the one thing that kind of cut me the deepest. Even more than Dwight. That, like, when Rashard left, I was really upset, and I knew, I understood why and all that stuff. You know, but, you know, like I said, I never ever questioned Otis decision making or anything like that. But from a personal standpoint, that's where I'm coming from when I talk about Rashard.
Yeah, he was a guy like you too that was beloved by everyone, it felt like. So I totally get that. It makes sense. I want to end on this note. When you look at your legacy and how you're going to be remembered, you know, how do you want people to remember Jameer Nelson?
I'm the underdog, man. I've always been a guy who worked to get what he had and he accomplished, and you know, I always wanted to be the best teammate, and I think, you know, it's a lot of guys. I don't know how many teammates I had, maybe 200-300. Hopefully all 200-300 have me in their top five best teammates. And you know, and for Orlando, like, that was the place where I spent the most time and made the most impact in the organization and in the community. I just, you know, my legacy, I want to be known as one of the guys who was a great leader, you know, a great person to the fans and to the media. And, you know, I always prided myself in my approach to the game of just trying to go win and do whatever I could do to help the team win.
Absolutely. Well, I love it. Good luck in broadcasting as well. Please don't take my job, but I know you're going to be great at it. and thank you for joining me, man. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, man. It was fun.
I had a great time. Make sure you guys all follow Jameer on Twitter at Jameer Nelson. Check out his broadcasting work. He is going to do an excellent job breaking down games for many years to come. And if you guys want to listen to more episodes of the Hoopsite Podcast, check us out on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, anywhere your favorite podcasts are found. And until next time, thanks for listening.